you. Well? Maeve Livingstone raised one perfect eyebrow. Her expression was not reassuring. Graham Coates liked her better in his imagination. I'm afraid we've had a rogue employee at the Graham Coates agency for quite a while, Maeve. I actually called in the police myself last week when I realized that something was amiss. The long arm of the law is already investigating. Due to the illustrious nature of several of the clients of the Graham Coates agency, yourself among them, the police are keeping this as quiet as possible, and who can blame them? She did not seem as mollified as he had hoped. He tried another tack. They have high hopes of recovering much, if not all, of the money. Maeve nodded. Graham Coates relaxed, but only a little. Can I ask which employee? Charles Nancy. I have to say I trusted him implicitly. It came as quite a shock. Oh, he's sweet. Appearances, pointed out Graham Coates, can be deceptive. She smiled then, and a very sweet smile it was. It won't wash, Graham. This has been going on for yonks, since long before Charles Nancy started here. Probably since before my time. Morris absolutely trusted you, and you stole from him, and now you're trying to tell me that you're hoping to frame one of your employees or blame one of your confederates. Well, it won't wash. No, said Graham Coates contritely. Sorry. She picked up the sheaf of papers. Out of interest, she said. How much do you think you got from Morris and me over the years? I make it about 3 million quid. Ah. He was not smiling at all now. It was certainly more than that. But still, that sounds about right. They looked at each other, and Graham Coates calculated furiously. He needed to buy time. That was what he needed. What if, he said, what if I were to repay it in full, in cash, now, with interest, let's say 50% of the amount in question? You're offering me £4.5 million, in cash. Graham Coates smiled at her. In exactly the same way that striking cobras tend not to. Absolutely. If you go to the police, then I will deny everything and hire excellent lawyers. In a worst-case scenario, after an extremely lengthy trial during which I shall be forced to blacken Morris's good name in every way I possibly can, I will be sentenced at most to 10 to 12 years in prison. I might actually serve 5 years with good behavior, and I should be a model prisoner. Given the general overcrowding of the prison services, I'd serve most of my sentence in an open prison, or even on day release. I don't see this as being too problematic. On the flip side, I can guarantee that if you go to the police, you will never get a penny of Morris's money. The alternative is to keep your mouth shut, get all the money you need, and more, while I buy myself a little time to do the decent thing, if you see what I mean. Maeve thought about it. I would like to see you rot in prison, she said. And then she sighed and nodded. All right, she said. I take the money. I never have to see or deal with you again. All future royalty checks come directly to me. Absolutely. The safe is over here, he told her. There was a bookcase on the far wall, on which were uniform leather-bound editions of Dickens, Thackeray, Trollope and Austen, all unread. He fumbled with a book, and the bookcase slipped to one side, revealing a door behind it, painted to match the wall. Maeve wondered if it would have a combination, but no, there was just a small keyhole, which Graham Coates unlocked with a large brass key. The door swung open. He reached in and turned on the light. It was a narrow room, lined with rather amateurishly fixed shelves. At the far end was a small fireproof filing cabinet. You can take it in cash or in jewellery or in a combination of the two, he said bluntly. I'd advise the latter. Lots of nice antique gold back there, very portable. He unlocked several strong boxes and displayed the contents. Rings and chains and lockets glittered and gleamed and shone. Maeve's mouth opened. Take a look, he told her, and she squeezed past him. It was a treasure cave. She pulled out a golden locket on a chain, held it up, stared at it in wonder. This is gorgeous, she said. It must be worth... And she broke off. In the polished gold of the locket, she saw something moving behind her, and she turned, which meant that the hammer did not hit her squarely on the back of the head, as Graham Coates had intended, but instead glanced off the side of her cheek. You little shit, she said, and she kicked him. Maeve had good legs and a powerful kick, but she and her attacker were at close quarters. Maeve's foot connected with his shin, and she reached for the hammer he was holding. Graham Coates smashed out with it. This time it connected, and Maeve stumbled to one side. Her eyes seemed to unfocus. He hit her again, squarely on the top of the head. And again, and again. And she went down. Graham Coates wished that he had a gun. A nice, sensible handgun. With a silencer, like in the films. Honestly, if it had ever occurred to him that he would need to kill someone in his office, he would have been much better prepared for it. He might even have laid in a supply of poison. That would have been wise. No need for any of this nonsense. There was blood and blonde hair adhering to the end of the hammer. He put it down with distaste, and stepping round the woman on the floor, he grabbed the safe deposit boxes containing the jewellery. He tipped them out onto his desk and returned them to the safe, where he removed an attaché case containing bundles of $100 bills and of 500 euro notes, and a small black velvet bag half full of uncut diamonds. He removed some files from the filing cabinet, and last but, as he would have pointed out, but by no means least, he took out from the secret room a small leather vanity case containing two wallets and two passports. Then he pushed the heavy door closed and locked it, and swung the bookcase back into position. He stood there, panting somewhat, and caught his breath. All in all, he decided, he was rather proud of himself. Good job, Graham. Good man. Good show. He had improvised with the materials at hand and come out ahead. Bluffed and been bold and creative, ready, as the poet said, to risk it all on a turn of pitch and toss. He had risked and he had won. He was the pitcher, he was the tosser. One day on his tropical paradise, he would write his memoirs, and people would learn how he had bested a dangerous woman, although he thought it might be better if she had actually been holding a gun. Probably, he realized on reflection, she had pulled a gun on him. He was fairly sure he had seen her reach for it. He had been extremely fortunate that the hammer had been there, that he had a toolkit in the room for moments of necessary DIY, or he would not have been able to act in self-defense with it so swiftly or so effectively. Only now did it occur to him to lock the main door to his office. There was, he noticed, blood on his shirt and on his hand, and on the sole of one shoe. He took off his shirt and wiped down his shoe with it. Then he dropped the shirt into the bin beneath his desk. He surprised himself by putting his hand to his mouth and licking the gobbet of blood off it, like a cat with his red tongue. And then he yawned. He took Maeve's papers from the desk, ran them through the shredder. She had a second set of documents in her briefcase, and he shredded them as well. He re-shredded the shreddings. He had a closet in the corner of his office with a suit hanging in it, and spare shirts, socks, underpants, and so on. You never knew when you would need to head to a first night from the office after all. Be prepared. He dressed, with care. There was a small suitcase with wheels on it in the closet too, of the kind that is meant to be placed in overhead lockers, and he put things into it, moving them around to make room. He called reception. "Annie," he said, "would you pop out and get me a sandwich? Not from Pret, no. I thought the new place in Brewer Street? I'm just wrapping up with Mrs. Livingstone. I may actually wind up taking her out for a spot of real lunch, but best to be prepared." He spent several minutes on the computer, running the kind of disk-cleaning program that takes your data, overwrites it with random ones and zeros, then grinds it up extremely small before finally depositing it at the bottom of the Thames wearing concrete overshoes. Then he walked down the hall, pulling his wheeled suitcase behind him. He put his head around one office door. "Popping out for a bit," he said. "I'll be back in about 3, if anyone asks." Annie was gone from reception, which he thought was a good thing. People would assume that Maeve Livingstone had already left the agency, just as he would rather that they expected him to return at any time. By the time they started looking for him, he would be a long way away. He descended in the lift. This was all happening early, he thought. He would not turn 50 for more than a year. But the exit mechanisms were already in place. He needed simply to think of it as a golden handshake, or perhaps a golden parachute. And then, pulling the wheelie suitcase behind him, he walked out of the front door, into the sunny Aldwych morning, and out of the Graham Coates agency forever. Spider had slept peacefully in his own enormous bed in his place in Fat Charlie's spare room. He had begun to wonder in a vague sort of way whether Fat Charlie had gone for good, and had resolved to investigate the matter the next time that he could in any way be bothered to do so, unless something more interesting distracted him or he forgot. He had slept late, and was now on his way to meet Rosie for lunch. He would pick her up at her flat, and they would go somewhere good. It was a beautiful day in early autumn, and Spider's happiness was infectious. This was because Spider was, give or take a little, a god. When you're a god, your emotions are contagious. Other people can catch them. When people stood near Spider on a day that he was this happy, their worlds would seem a little brighter. If he hummed a song, other people around him would start humming, in key, like something from a musical. Of course, if he yawned, 100 people nearby would yawn, and when he was miserable, it spread like a damp river mist, making the world even gloomier for everyone caught up in it. It wasn't anything he did, it was something that he was. Right now, the only thing casting a damper on his happiness was that he had resolved to tell Rosie the truth. Spider was not terribly good at telling the truth. He regarded truth as fundamentally malleable, more or less a matter of opinion, and Spider was able to muster some pretty impressive opinions when he had to. Being an imposter was not the problem. He liked being an imposter. He was good at it. It fitted in with his plans, which were fairly simple and could until now have been summarized more or less as A. Go somewhere, B. Enjoy yourself, and C. Leave before you get bored. And it was now, he knew deep down, definitely time to leave. The world was his lobster, his bib was round his neck, and he had a pot of melted butter and an array of grotesque but effective lobster-eating implements and devices at the ready. Only he didn't want to go. He was having second thoughts about all this, something Spider found fairly disconcerting. Normally he didn't even have first thoughts about things. Life without thinking had been perfectly pleasant. Instinct, impulse, and an obscene amount of luck had served him quite well up to now. But even miracles can only take you so far. Spider walked down the street, and people smiled at him. He had agreed with Rosie that he would meet her at her flat, so he was pleasantly surprised to see her standing at the end of the road waiting for him. He felt a pang of something that was still not entirely guilt, and waved. "Rosie! Hey!" She came towards him along the pavement, and he began to grin. They would sort things out. Everything would work out for the best. Everything would be fine. "You look $1 million, he told her. "Maybe 2 million. What are you hungry for?" Rosie smiled and shrugged. They were passing a Greek restaurant. "Is Greek okay?" She nodded. They walked down some steps and went inside. It was dark and empty, having only just opened, and the proprietor pointed them towards a nook, or possibly a cranny, towards the rear. They sat opposite each other, at a table just big enough for two. Spider said, "There's something that I wanted to talk to you about." She said nothing. "It's not bad," he went on. "Well, it's not good, but, well, it's something you ought to know." The proprietor asked them if they were ready to order anything. "Coffee," said Spider, and Rosie nodded her agreement. "Two coffees," said Spider. "And if you can give us 5 minutes, I need a little privacy here." The proprietor withdrew. Rosie looked at Spider inquiringly. He took a deep breath. "Right, okay, let me just say this because it isn't easy and I don't know what I can..." "Right, okay. Look, I'm not Fat Charlie. I know you think I am, but I'm not. I'm his brother, Spider. You think I'm him because we sort of look alike." She did not say anything. "Well, I don't really look like him, but, you know, none of this really comes easy to me. Okay, I can't stop thinking about you. So, I mean, I know you're engaged to my brother, but I'm sort of asking you if you, well, if you think about maybe dumping him and possibly going out with me." A pot of coffee arrived on a small silver tray with two cups.
"Greek coffee," said the proprietor, who had brought it.
"Yeah, thanks. I did ask for a couple of minutes."
"It's very hot," said the proprietor. "Very hot coffee. Strong. Greek. Not Turkish."
"That's great. Listen, if you don't mind, 5 minutes, please." The proprietor shrugged and walked away. "You probably hate me," said Spider. "If I was you, I'd probably hate me too. But I mean this, more than I've ever meant anything in my life." She was just looking at him without expression, and he said, "Please, just say something, anything." Her lips moved as if she were trying to find the right words to say. Spider waited. Her mouth opened. His first thought was that she was eating something, because the thing he saw between her teeth was brown and was certainly not a tongue. Then it moved its head and its eyes, little black bead eyes, stared at him. Rosie opened her mouth impossibly wide, and the birds came out. Spider said, "Rosie?" and then the air was filled with beaks and feathers and claws, one after the other. Birds poured out from her throat, each accompanied by a tiny coughing, choking noise in a stream directed at him. He threw up an arm to protect his eyes, and something hurt his wrist. He flailed out, and something flew at his face, heading for his eyes. He jerked his head backward, and the beak punctured his cheek. A moment of nightmare clarity. There was still a woman sitting opposite him. What he could no longer understand was how he could ever have mistaken her for Rosie. She was older than Rosie, for a start. Her blue-black hair streaked here and there with silver. Her skin was not the warm brown of Rosie's skin, but black as flint. She was wearing a ragged ochre raincoat, and she grinned and opened her mouth wide once more, and now inside her mouth he could see the cruel beaks and crazy eyes of seagulls. Spider did not stop to think. He acted. He grabbed the handle of the coffee pot, swept it up in one hand, while with the other he pulled off the lid, then he jerked the pot toward the woman in the seat opposite him. The contents of the pot, scalding hot black coffee, went all over her. She hissed in pain. Birds crashed and flapped through the air of the cellar restaurant, but now there was nobody sitting opposite him, and the birds flew without direction, flapping into walls wildly.
The proprietor said, "Sir, are you hurt? I am sorry, they must have come in from the street."
"I'm fine," said Spider.
"Your face is bleeding," said the man.
He handed Spider a napkin, and Spider pressed it against his cheek. The cut stung. Spider offered to help the man get the birds out. He opened the door to the street, but now the place was as empty of birds as it had been before his arrival. Spider pulled out a £5 note. "Here," he said, "for the coffee. I've got to go." The proprietor nodded gratefully.
"Keep the napkin."
Spider stopped and thought.
"When I came in," he asked, "was there a woman with me?"
The proprietor looked puzzled, possibly even scared. Spider could not be sure.
"I do not remember," he said, as if dazed. "If you had been alone, I would not have seated you back there, but I do not know."
Spider went back out into the street. The day was still bright, but the sunlight no longer seemed reassuring. He looked around. He saw a pigeon shuffling and pecking at an abandoned ice cream cone, a sparrow on a window ledge, and high above, a flash of white in the sunlight. Its wings extended, a seagull circled. Chapter 9, in which Fat Charlie answers the door and Spider encounters flamingos. Fat Charlie's luck was changing. He could feel it. The plane on which he was returning home had been oversold, and he had found himself bumped up to first class. The meal was excellent. Halfway across the Atlantic, a flight attendant came over to inform him that he had won a complimentary box of chocolates and presented it to him. He put it in his overhead locker and ordered a drambuie on ice. He would get home. He would sort everything out with Graham Coates. After all, if there was one thing that Fat Charlie was certain of, it was the honesty of his own accounting. He would make everything good with Rosie. Everything was going to be just great. He wondered if Spider would already be gone when he got home, or whether he would get the satisfaction of throwing him out. He hoped it would be the latter. Fat Charlie wanted to see his brother apologize, possibly even grovel. He started to imagine the things that he was going to say. "Get out," said Fat Charlie, "and take your sunshine, your jacuzzi, and your bedroom with you."
"Sorry,"
said the flight attendant. "Talking," said Fat Charlie, "to myself. But even the embarrassment he felt at this wasn't really that bad. He didn't even hope the plane would crash and end his mortification. Life was definitely looking up. He opened the little kit of useful amenities he had been given, and put on his eyeshade, and pushed his seat back as far as it would go, which was most of the way. He thought about Rosie, although the Rosie in his mind kept shifting, morphing into someone smaller, who wasn't really wearing much of anything. Fat Charlie guiltily imagined her dressed, and was mortified when he realized that she seemed to be wearing a police uniform. He felt terrible about this, he told himself, but it didn't seem to make much of an impression. He ought to feel ashamed of himself. He ought to... Fat Charlie shifted in his seat and emitted one small, satisfied snore. He was still in an excellent mood when he landed at Heathrow. He took the Heathrow Express into Paddington, and was pleased to note that in his brief absence from England, the sun had decided to come out.
"Every little thing," he told himself, "gonna be all right."
The only odd note, which added a flavour of wrongness to the morning, occurred halfway through the train journey. He was staring out of the window, wishing he had bought a newspaper at Heathrow. The train was passing an expanse of green, a school playing field, perhaps, when the sky seemed momentarily to darken, and, with a hiss of brakes, the train stopped at a signal. That did not disturb Fat Charlie. It was England in the autumn. The sun was, by definition, something that only happened when it wasn't cloudy or raining. But there was a figure standing on the edge of the green, by a stand of trees. At first glance, he thought it was a scarecrow. That was foolish. It could not have been a scarecrow. Scarecrows are found in fields, not on football pitches. Scarecrows certainly aren't left on the edge of the woodland. Anyway, if it was a scarecrow, it was doing a very poor job. There were crows everywhere, after all. Big black ones. And then it moved. It was too far away to be anything more than a shape, a slight figure in a tattered brown raincoat. Still, Fat Charlie knew it. He knew that if he had been close enough, he would have seen a face chipped from obsidian, and raven black hair, and eyes that held madness. Then the train jerked, and began to move, and in moments the woman in the brown raincoat was out of sight. Fat Charlie felt uncomfortable. He had practically convinced himself by now that what had happened, what he thought had happened in Mrs. Dunwoody's front room, had been some form of hallucination, a high-octane dream, true on some level, but not a real thing. Not something that had happened, rather, it was symbolic of a greater truth. He could not have gone to a real place, nor struck a real bargain, could he? It was only a metaphor, after all. He did not ask himself why he was now so certain that everything would soon begin to improve. There was reality, and there was reality, and some things were more real than others. Faster and faster, the train rattled him further into London. Spider was almost home from the Greek restaurant, napkin pushed against his cheek, when someone touched him on the shoulder. "Charles," said Rosie. Spider jumped, or at least he jerked and made a startled noise. "Charles, are you all right? What happened to your cheek?" He stared at her. "Are you you?" he asked.
"What?"
"Are you Rosie?"
"What kind of a question is that? Of course I'm Rosie. What did you do to your cheek?"
He pressed the napkin against his cheek. "I cut it," he said.
"Let me see."
She took his hand away from his cheek. The centre of the white napkin was stained crimson, as if he had bled into it, but his cheek was whole and untouched.
"There's nothing there."
"Oh."
"Charles, are you all right?"
"Yes," he said. "I am. Unless I'm not. I think we should go back to my place. I think I'll be safer there."
"We were going to have lunch," said Rosie, in the tone of a voice of one who worries that she'll only understand what's actually going on when a TV presenter leaps out and reveals the hidden cameras.
"Yes," said Spider, "I know. I think someone just tried to kill me, though, and she pretended she was you."
"Nobody's trying to kill you," said Rosie, failing to sound like she wasn't humouring him.
"Even if nobody's trying to kill me, can we skip lunch and go back to my place? I've got food there."
"Of course."
Rosie followed him down the road, wondering when Fat Charlie had lost all that weight. He looked good, she thought. He looked really good. They walked into Maxwell Gardens in silence. He said, "Look at that."
"What?"
He showed her. The fresh bloodstain had vanished from the napkin. It was now perfectly white.
"Is it a magic trick?"
"If it is, I didn't do it," he said, for once. He dropped the napkin into a bin. As he did so, a taxi pulled up in front of Fat Charlie's house, and Fat Charlie got out, rumpled and blinking and carrying a white plastic bag. Rosie looked at Fat Charlie. She looked at Spider. She looked back at Fat Charlie, who had opened the bag and pulled out an enormous box of chocolates.
"They're for you," he said.
Rosie took the chocolates and said, "Thank you." There were two men, and they looked and sounded completely different, and she still could not work out which one of them was her fiancé.
"I'm going mad, aren't I?" she said,
her voice taut. It was easier now she knew what was wrong. The thinner of the two Fat Charlies, the one with the earring, put his hand on her shoulder. "You need to go home," he said. "Then you need a nap. When you wake up, you'll have forgotten all about this." Well, she thought, that makes life easier. It's better with a plan. She walked back to her flat with a spring in her step, carrying her box of chocolates.
What did you do? Asked Fat Charlie. She just seemed to turn off.
Spider shrugged. I didn't want to upset her, he said.
Why didn't you tell her the truth?
It didn't seem appropriate.
Like you'd know what was appropriate.
Spider touched the front door and it opened.
I have keys, you know, said Fat Charlie. It's my front door.
They walked into the hallway, walked up the stairs.
Where have you been? Asked Spider.
Nowhere.
Out, said Fat Charlie, as if he were a teenager.
I was attacked by birds in the restaurant this morning. Do you know anything about that?
You do, don't you?
Not really.
Maybe. It's just time for you to leave, that's all.
Don't start anything, said Spider.
Me? Me start anything? I think I've been a model of restraint. You came into my life, you got my boss upset, and got the police onto me. You've been kissing my girlfriend, you screwed up my life.
Hey, said Spider, you ask me? You've done a great job of screwing up your life on your own.
Fat Charlie clenched his fist, swung back, and hit Spider in the jaw like they do on the movies. Spider staggered back, more surprised than hurt. He put his hand to his lip, then looked down at the blood on his hand.
You hit me, he said.
I can do it again, said Fat Charlie, who wasn't sure that he could. His hand hurt.
Spider said, yeah? And launched himself at Fat Charlie, pummeling him with his fists, and Fat Charlie went over, his arm around Spider's waist, pulling Spider down with him.
They rolled up and down the hallway floor, hitting and flailing at each other. Fat Charlie half expected Spider to launch some kind of magical counterattack or to be supernaturally strong, but the two of them seemed fairly evenly matched. Both of them fought unscientifically, like boys, like brothers, and as they fought, Fat Charlie thought he remembered doing this once before, a long, long time ago. Spider was smarter and faster, but if Fat Charlie could just get on top of him and get Spider's hands out of the way...
Fat Charlie grabbed for Spider's right hand, twisted it behind Spider's back, then sat on his brother's chest, putting all his weight on him.
"Give in?" he asked.
"No!" Spider wriggled and twisted, but Fat Charlie was solidly in position, sitting on Spider's chest.
"I want you to promise," said Fat Charlie, "to get out of my life and to leave me and Rosie alone forever!"
At this, Spider bucked angrily, and Fat Charlie was dislodged. He landed sprawled on the kitchen floor.
"Look!" said Spider. I told you!
There was a banging on the door downstairs, an imperious knocking of the kind that indicated someone needed to come in rather urgently. Fat Charlie glared at Spider, and Spider scowled at Fat Charlie, and slowly they got to their feet.
Shall I answer it? Said Spider.
No, said Fat Charlie. It's my bloody house, and I'm going to bloody answer my own front door, thank you very much.
Whatever.
Fat Charlie edged towards the stairs. Then he turned round.
Once I've dealt with this, he said, I'm dealing with you. Pack your stuff, you're on your way out.
He walked downstairs, tucking himself in, brushing the dust off, and generally trying to make it look as if he hadn't been brawling on the floor. He opened the door. There were two large, uniformed policemen, and one smaller, rather more exotic policewoman in extremely plain clothes.
Charles Nancy, said Daisy.
She looked at him as if he was a stranger, her eyes expressionless.
"Glumph,"
said Fat Charlie.
"Mr. Nancy," she said, "you are under arrest. You have the right."
Fat Charlie turned back to the interior of the house.
"Bastard!" he shouted up the stairs. "Bastard, bastard, bastard, him bastardy bastard!"
Daisy tapped him on the arm.
"Do you want to come quietly?" she asked quietly. "Only if you don't, we can subdue you first. I wouldn't recommend it, though. They're very enthusiastic subduers."
"I'll come quietly," said Fat Charlie.
"That's good," said Daisy.
She walked Fat Charlie outside and locked him into the back of a black police van. The police searched the flat. The rooms were empty of life. At the end of the hall was a little spare bedroom, containing several boxes of books and toy cars. They poked around in there, but they didn't find anything interesting. Spider lay on the couch in his bedroom and sulked. He had gone to his room when Fat Charlie went off to answer the door. He needed to be on his own. He did do confrontations terribly well. When he got to that point was normally when he went away, and right now Spider knew it was time to go. But he still didn't want to leave.
He wasn't sure that sending Rosie home was the right thing to have done. What he wanted to do, and Spider was driven entirely by wants, never by oughts or shoulds, was to tell Rosie that he wanted her. He, Spider. That he wasn't Fat Charlie. That he was something quite different. And that, in itself, wasn't the problem. He could simply have said to her, with enough conviction, "I'm actually Spider, Fat Charlie's brother, and you're completely okay with this. It doesn't bother you." And the universe would have pushed Rosie just a little, and she would accept it, just as she'd gone home earlier. She'd be fine with it. She would not have minded it, not at all. Except he knew somewhere deep inside she would. Human beings do not like being pushed about by gods. They may seem to, on the surface, but somewhere on the inside, underneath it all, they sense it and they resent it. They know. Spider could tell her to be happy about the situation, and she would be happy. But it would be as real as painting a smile on her face, a smile that she would truly believe in every way that mattered was her own. In the short term, and until now Spider had only ever thought in the short term, none of this would be important, but in the long term it could only lead to problems. He didn't want some kind of seething, furious creature, someone who, though she hated him way down deep, was perfectly placid and dull-like and normal on the surface. He wanted Rosie. And that wouldn't be Rosie, would it? Spider stared out of the window, at the glorious waterfall and the tropical sky beyond it, and Spider began to wonder when Fat Charlie would come knocking on his door. Something had happened this morning in the restaurant, and he was certain that his brother knew more about it than he was saying. After a while, he got bored with waiting, and wandered back into Fat Charlie's flat. There was nobody there. The place was a mess. It looked like it had been turned upside down by trained professionals. Spider decided that, in all probability, Fat Charlie had messed the place up himself, to indicate how upset he was that Spider had beaten him in their fight. He looked out of the window. There was a police car parked outside beside a black police van. As he watched, they drove away. He made himself some toast, and he buttered it and ate it. Then he walked through the flat, carefully ensuring that all the curtains were closed. The doorbell rang. Spider closed the last of the curtains, then he walked downstairs. He opened the door and Rosie looked at him. She looked a little dazed. He looked at her. "Well, aren't you going to invite me in?" "Of course, come in." She walked up the stairs. "What happened here? It looks like an earthquake hit." "Here? Why are you just sitting in the dark?" She went to open the curtains.
"Don't do that! Just keep them closed."
"What are you scared of?" asked Rosie. Spider looked out of the window.
"Birds," he said eventually.
"But birds are our friends," said Rosie, as if addressing a small child.
"Birds," Spider said, "are the last of the dinosaurs. Tiny velociraptors with wings, devouring defenseless wiggly things and nuts and fish and other birds. They get the early worms. And have you ever watched a chicken eat? They may look innocent, but birds are... well, they're vicious."
"There was a thing on the news the other day," said Rosie, "about a bird who saved a man's life."
"That doesn't change the fact that..."
"It was a raven. Or a crow. One of those big black ones. The man was lying on the lawn in his home in California, reading a magazine, and he hears this cawing and cawing, and it's a raven trying to attract his attention. So he gets up and goes over to the tree it's perched on, and down beneath it is a mountain lion that had been getting all ready to pounce on him. So he went inside. If that raven hadn't warned him, he would have been lion food."
"I don't think that's usual raven behavior," said Spider. "But whether one raven once saved someone's life or not, it doesn't change anything. Birds are still out to get me."
"Right," said Rosie, trying to sound as if she wasn't humoring him. "Birds are out to get you."
"Yes."
"And this is because... there must be a reason. You can't tell me the great plurality of birds has just decided to treat you as an enormous early worm for no particular reason." He said,
"I don't think you believe me." And he meant it.
"Charlie, you've always been really honest. I mean, I've trusted you. If you tell me something, I'll do my best to believe it. I'll try really hard. I love you and I believe in you. So why don't you let me find out if I believe you or not?"
Spider thought about this. Then he reached out for her hand and he squeezed it.
"I think I ought to show you something," he said.
He led her to the end of the corridor,
They stopped outside the door to Fat Charlie's spare room.
"There's something in here," he said. "I think it'll explain it a bit better than I can."
"You're a superhero," she said, "and this is where you keep the bat poles?"
"No."
"Is it something kinky? You'd like to dress up in a twin set and pearls and call yourself Dora?"
"No."
"It's not a model train set, is it?"
Spider pushed open the door to Fat Charlie's spare room, and at the same time he opened the door to his bedroom. The picture windows at the end of the room showed a waterfall, which crashed down into a jungle pool far below. The sky through the windows was bluer than sapphires. Rosie made a small noise. She turned around, walked back down the hall, into the kitchen, and looked out of the window at the grey London sky, doughy and unwelcoming. She came back.
"I don't understand," she said. "Charlie, what's happening?"
"I'm not Charlie," said Spider. "Look at me. Really look at me. I don't even look like him."
She made no pretense of humoring him any longer. Her eyes were wide and scared.
"I'm his brother," said Spider. "I've screwed everything up. Everything. And I think probably the best thing I can do is just get out of all your lives and go away."
"So where's Fat... where's Charlie?"
"I don't know. We were having a fight. He went off to answer the door, and I went off to my room, and he didn't come back."
"He didn't come back? And you didn't even try to find out what had happened to him?"
He might have been taken away by the police," said Spider. "It's just an idea. I have no proof or anything."
"What's your name?"
she demanded.
"Spider."
Rosie repeated it.
"Spider."
Outside the window, above the spray of the waterfall, she could see a flock of flamingos in the air, the sunlight blurring their wings in pink and white. They were stately and uncountable, and it was one of the most beautiful things Rosie had ever seen. She looked back at Spider, and looking at him, she could not understand how she had ever believed that this man was Fat Charlie. Where Fat Charlie was easygoing, open, and uncomfortable, this man was like a steel rod bent back and ready to snap.
"You really aren't him, are you?"
"I told you I wasn't."
Who did I sleep with?"
"That would be me," said Spider.
"I thought so," said Rosie.
She slapped him as hard as she could across his face. He could feel his lips start bleeding once more.
"I guess I deserved that," he said.
"Of course you deserved it."
She paused. Then she said,
"Did Fat Charlie know about this? About you? That you were going out with me?"
"Well, yes, but he..."
"You are both sick," she said. "Sick, sick, evil men. I hope you rot in hell."
She took one last puzzled glance around the enormous bedroom, and then out of the bedroom window at the jungle trees and the huge waterfall and the flock of flamingos, and walked away down the hall. Spider sat down on the floor, with a thin trickle of blood coming from his lower lip, feeling stupid. He heard the front door slam. He walked over to the hot tub and dipped the end of a fluffy towel into the hot water. Then he wrung it out and put it on his mouth.
"I don't need any of this," said Spider. He said it aloud. It's easier to lie to yourself when you say things out loud. "I didn't need any of you people a week ago, and I don't need you now. I don't care. I'm done."
The flamingos hit the window glass like feathery pink cannonballs, and the glass shattered, fragments of window flying across the room, scattering themselves and embedding themselves in the walls, the floor, the bed. The air was filled with plummeting pale pink bodies, a confusion of huge pink wings and curved black beaks. The roar of a waterfall exploded into the room. Spider pushed back against the wall. There were flamingos between him and the door, hundreds of them, 5-foot-tall birds, all legs and neck. He got to his feet and took several steps through a minefield of angry pink birds, each of them glaring at him through mad pink eyes. From a distance, they might have been beautiful. One of them snapped at Spider's hand. It didn't break the skin, but it hurt. Spider's bedroom was a large room, but it was rapidly filling with crash-landing flamingos, and there was a dark cloud in the blue sky above the waterfall that appeared to be another flock on its way. They were pecking at him, and clawing at him, and buffeting him with their wings, and he knew that that was not actually the problem. The problem would be being suffocated under a fluffy pink blanket of feathers with birds attached.
It would be an astonishingly undignified way to go, crushed by birds, and not even particularly intelligent birds.
Think, he told himself, they're flamingos, bird brains, you're a spider.
So, he thought back at himself, irritated, tell me something I don't know. The flamingos on the ground were mobbing him. The ones in the air were diving towards him. He pulled his jacket over his head, and then the airborne flamingos began hitting him. It was like having someone firing chickens at you. He staggered and went down.
Well, trick them, stupid!
Spider pushed himself to his feet and waded through the sea of wings and beaks until he reached the window, now an open jaw of jagged glass.
Stupid birds! He said cheerfully.
He pulled himself up onto the window ledge. Flamingos are not famed for their cutting intelligence, nor for their problem-solving abilities. Confronted with a twist of wire and a bottle with something edible in it, a crow might try to make a tool out of the wire in order to get at the contents of the bottle. A flamingo, on the other hand, would try and eat the wire if it looked like a shrimp, or possibly even if it didn't, just in case it was a new kind of shrimp. So if there was something slightly smoky and insubstantial about the man who stood on the window ledge insulting them, the flamingos failed to perceive it. They glared at him with the crazed pink eyes of killer rabbits, and they rushed towards him. The man dived from the window, down into the spray of the waterfall, and 1,000 flamingos launched themselves into the air after him, many of them, given the run-up of flamingo knees to get properly airborne, tumbling like stones. Soon the bedroom contained only injured or dead flamingos, the ones who had broken the windows, the ones who had crashed into the walls, the ones who had been crushed beneath other flamingos. Those of the birds who were still alive watched the bedroom door open, apparently by itself, and close again, but being flamingos, they thought very little of it. Spider stood in the corridor of Fat Charlie's flat and tried to catch his breath. He concentrated on letting the bedroom stop existing, which was something that he hated to do, mostly because he was incredibly proud of his sound system, and also because it was where he kept his stuff. You can always get more stuff, though. If you're Spider, all you really have to do is ask. Rosie's mother was not a woman given to gloating loudly, so when Rosie broke down in tears on the Chippendale sofa, her mother refrained from whooping, from singing, or from doing a small victory dance and then shimmying around the room. A careful observer, however, might have noticed a glint of triumph in her eyes. She gave Rosie a large glass of vitaminized water with an ice cube in it, and listened to her daughter's tearful litany of heartbreak and deception. By the end of it, the glint of triumph had been replaced with a look of confusion, and her head was starting to spin.
"So Fat Charlie wasn't really Fat Charlie?" said Rosie's mother. "No, well, yes, Fat Charlie is Fat Charlie, but for the last week I've been seeing his brother."
"They are twins."
"No, I don't even think they look alike. I don't know, I'm so confused."
"So which one of them did you break up with?"
Rosie blew her nose.
"I broke up with Spider. That's Fat Charlie's brother."
"But you weren't engaged to him."
"No, but I thought I was. I thought he was Fat Charlie."
"So you broke up with Fat Charlie as well?"
"Sort of. I just haven't told him yet."
Did he know about this brother thing? Was it some kind of evil, kinky conspiracy they did to my poor girl?"
"I don't think so, but it doesn't matter. I can't marry him."
"No," agreed her mother. "You certainly cannot. Not one bit."
Inside, in her head, she did a victory jig and set off a large but tasteful celebratory display of fireworks.
"We can find you a good boy. Don't you worry. That Fat Charlie, he was always up to no good. I knew it the first moment I saw him. He ate my wax fruit. I knew he was trouble. Where is he now?"
"I'm not sure. Spider said he might have been taken away by the police," said Rosie.
"Ha!"
said her mother, who increased the fireworks in her head to New Year's Eve at Disneyland proportions and mentally sacrificed 12 flawless black bulls for good measure. Aloud, all she said was,
"Probably in prison, you ask me. Best place for him. I always said that was where that young man would end up."
Rosie began to cry, if anything, even harder than before. She pulled out another wadge of paper tissues and blew her nose with an extreme honk. She swallowed bravely. Then she cried some more. Her mother patted the back of Rosie's hand as reassuringly as she knew how.
"Of course you can't marry him," she said. "You can't marry a convict. but if he's in prison, you can easily break off the engagement."
A spectre of a smile haunted the corners of her lips as she said,
"I could call on him for you, or go there on a visitor's day and tell him he's a lousy crook and you never want to see him again. We could get a restraining order as well," she added helpfully.
"That's not why I can't marry Fat Charlie," said Rosie.
"No?" asked her mother, raising one perfectly penciled eyebrow.
"No," said Rosie. "I can't marry Fat Charlie because I'm not in love with him."
"Of course you aren't. I always knew that. It was a girlish infatuation. But now you see the true..."
"I'm in love,"
continued Rosie, as if her mother had not spoken,
"with Spider, his brother."
The expression that made its way across her mother's face then was a cloud of wasps arriving at a picnic.
"It's okay," said Rosie. "I'm not going to marry him either. I've told him I never want to see him again."
Rosie's mother pursed her lips.
"Well," she said, "I can't pretend I understand any of this, but I can't say it's bad news either."
The gears in her head shifted and the cogs interlocked in new and interesting ways. Ratchets ratcheted and springs resprung.
"You know," she said, "what would be the best thing for you right now? Have you thought about taking a little holiday? I'm happy to pay for it. All the money I'm saving on the wedding, after all."
That may have been the wrong thing to say. Rosie began to sob into her tissues once again. Her mother went on.
"Anyway, it would be my treat. I know you've got holiday time you haven't used at work, and you said things were quiet right now. At a time like this, a girl needs to get away from everything and simply relax."
Rosie wondered whether she'd misjudged her mother all these years. She sniffed and swallowed and said,
"That would be nice."
"Then it's settled," said her mother. "I shall come with you, to take care of my baby."
In her head, underneath the grand finale of the fireworks display, she added, "And to make sure that my baby only meets the right sort of man."
"Where are we going?"
asked Rosie.
"We're going to go," said her mother, "on a cruise."
Fat Charlie was not handcuffed. That was good. Everything else was bad, but at least he wasn't in handcuffs. Life had become a confused blur, filled with two sharp details, the duty sergeant scratching his nose and signing him in.
"Cell 6 is free."
Through a green door and then the smell of the cells. A low-level stench he had never before encountered, but which was immediately and horribly familiar. A pervasive fug of yesterday's vomit and disinfectant and smoke and stale blankets and unflushed toilets and despair. It was the smell of things at the bottom, and that was where Fat Charlie seemed to have ended up.
"When you need to flush the lavvy," said the policeman, accompanying him down the corridor, "you press the button in your cell. One of us will be by sooner or later to pull a chain for you. Stops you trying to flush away the evidence."
"Evidence of what?"
"Leave it out, sunshine."
Fat Charlie sighed. He'd been flushing away his own bodily waste products since he'd been old enough to take a certain pride in the activity, and the loss of that, more than the loss of his liberty, told him that everything had changed.
"It's your first time," said the policeman.
"Sorry?"
"Drugs?"
said the policeman.
"No, thank you," said Fat Charlie. "Is that what you're in for?"
"I don't know what I'm in for," said Fat Charlie. "I'm innocent."
"White-collar crime, eh?"
said the policeman, and he shook his head.
"I'll tell you something the blue-collar boys know without being told. The easier you make it on us, the easier we make it on you. You white-collar people, always standing up for your rights, you just make it harder on yourselves."
He opened the door to cell 6.
"Home, sweet home," he said.
The cell stench was worse inside the room, which had been painted in the kind of speckled paint that resists graffiti, and which contained only a shelf-like bed, low to the ground, and a lidless toilet in the corner. Fat Charlie put the blanket he'd been issued down on the bed.
"Right," said the policeman. "Well, make yourself at home, and if you get bored, please don't block the toilet with your blanket."
"Why would I do that?"
"I often wonder that myself," said the policeman. "Why indeed? Perhaps it breaks the monotony. I shouldn't know. Being a law-abiding sort with a police pension waiting for me, I've never actually had to spend much time in the cells."
"You know, I didn't do it," said Fat Charlie, "whatever it was."
"That's good,"
said the policeman.
"Excuse me," said Fat Charlie, "do I get anything to read? Does this look like a lending library to you?"
"No."
"When I was a young copper, bloke asked me for a book. I went and found in the book I'd been reading, J.T. Edson it was, or maybe Louis L'Amour.
He only went and blocked up his toilet with it, didn't he? Won't catch me doing that again in a hurry.
Then he went out and locked the door, with Fat Charlie on the inside and himself on the outside.
The oddest thing, thought Graham Coates, who was not given to self-inspection, was how normal and chipper and generally good he felt.
The captain told them to fasten their safety belts and mentioned that they would be landing soon on St. Andrews. St. Andrews was a small Caribbean island which, on declaring independence in 1962, had elected to demonstrate its freedom from colonial rule in a number of ways, including the creation of its own judiciary and a singular lack of extradition treaties with the rest of the world. The plane landed. Graham Coates got off and walked across the sunny tarmac, dragging his wheeled bag behind him. He produced the appropriate passport, Basil Finnegan's, and had it stamped, collected the rest of his luggage from the carousel, and walked out through an unattended customs hall, into the tiny airport, and from there into the glorious sunshine. He wore a t-shirt and shorts and sandals and looked like a British holidaymaker abroad. His groundskeeper was waiting for him outside the airport, and Graham Coates sat himself in the back of the black Mercedes and said, "Home, please." On the road out of Williamstown, the road to his clifftop estate, he stared out at the island with a satisfied and proprietorial smile on his face. It occurred to him that before he left England, he had left a woman for dead. He wondered if she was still alive. He rather doubted it. It did not bother him to have killed. It felt, instead, immensely satisfying, like something he had needed to do to feel complete. He wondered if he would ever get to do it again. He wondered if it would be soon.
Chapter 10, in which Fat Charlie sees the world and Maeve Livingstone is dissatisfied.
Fat Charlie sat on the blanket on the metal bed and waited for something to happen, but it didn't. What felt like several months passed extremely slowly. He tried to go to sleep, but he couldn't remember how. He banged on the door. Someone shouted, "Shut up!" But he couldn't tell whether it was an officer or a fellow inmate. He walked around the cell for what, at a conservative estimate, he felt must have been 2 or 3 years. Then he sat down and let eternity wash over him. Daylight was visible through the thick glass block at the top of the wall that did duty as a window. By all appearances, the same daylight that had been visible when the door was locked behind him that morning. Fat Charlie tried to remember what people did in prison to pass the time, but all he could come up with was keeping secret diaries and hiding things in their bottoms. He had nothing to write on, and felt that a definite measure of how well one was getting on in life was not having to hide things in one's bottom. Nothing happened. Nothing continued to happen. More nothing. The return of nothing. Son of nothing. Nothing rides again. Nothing and Abbott and Costello meet the Wolfman. When the door was unlocked, Fat Charlie nearly cheered.
"Right, exercise yard. You can have a cigarette if you need one. I don't smoke. Filthy habit, anyway."
The exercise yard was an open space in the middle of the police station, surrounded by walls on all sides and topped by wire mesh, which Fat Charlie walked around while deciding that, if there was one thing he didn't like being in, it was police custody. Fat Charlie had had no real liking for the police, but until now, he had still managed to cling to a fundamental trust in the natural order of things, a conviction that there was some kind of power. A Victoria might have thought of it as providence, that ensured that the guilty would be punished while the innocent would be set free. This faith had collapsed in the face of recent events, and had been replaced by the suspicion that he would spend the rest of his life pleading his innocence to a variety of implacable judges and tormentors, many of whom would look like Daisy, and that he would in all probability wake up in cell 6 the following morning to find that he had been transformed into an enormous cockroach. He had definitely been transported to the kind of maleficent universe that transformed people into cockroaches. Something dropped out of the sky above him, onto the wire mesh. Fat Charlie looked up. A blackbird stared down at him with lofty disinterest. There was more fluttering, and the blackbird was joined by several sparrows, and by something that Fat Charlie thought was probably a thrush. They stared at him. He stared back at them. More birds came. It would have been hard for Fat Charlie to say exactly when the accumulation of birds on the wire mesh moved from interesting to terrifying. It was somewhere in the first 100 or so anyway, and it was in the way. They didn't coo or caw or trill or sing. They simply landed on the wire and they watched him.
"Go away," said Fat Charlie.
As one bird, they didn't. Instead, they spoke. They said his name. Fat Charlie went over to the door in the corner. He banged on it. He said,
"Excuse me,"
a few times, and then he started shouting,
"Help!"
A clunk. The door was opened, and a heavy-lidded member of Her Majesty's Constabulary said,
"This had better be good."
Fat Charlie pointed upwards. He didn't say anything. He didn't need to. The constabular mouth dropped open peculiarly wide, and it hung there slackly. Fat Charlie's mother would have told the man to shut his mouth or something would fly into it. The mesh sagged under the weight of thousands of birds. Tiny avian eyes stared down, unblinkingly.
"Christ on a bike," said the policeman,
and he ushered Fat Charlie back into the cell block without saying another word. Maeve Livingstone was in pain. She was sprawled on the floor. She woke, and her hair and face were wet and warm. And then she slept. And when next she woke, her hair and face were sticky and cold. She dreamed and woke and dreamed again. Woke enough to be conscious of the hurt at the back of her head, and then, because it was easier to sleep, and because when she slept it did not hurt, she allowed sleep to embrace her like a comfortable blanket. In her dream, she was walking through a television studio, looking for Morris. Occasionally, she would catch glimpses of him on the monitors. He always looked concerned. She tried to find her way out, but always led her back to the studio floor. "I'm so cold," she thought, and knew that she was awake once more. The pain, though, had subsided. All things considered, thought Maeve, she felt pretty good. There was something she was upset about, but she was not entirely sure what it was. Perhaps it had been another part of her dream. It was dark wherever she was. It seemed to be some kind of broom closet, and she put out her arms to avoid bumping into anything in the darkness. She took a few nervous steps with her arms outstretched and her eyes closed. Then she opened her eyes. Now she was in a room she knew. It was an office. Graham Coates's office. She remembered then. The just-awake grogginess was still there. She wasn't yet thinking clearly, knew she wouldn't be properly all there until she had had her morning cup of coffee, but still, it came to her. Graham Coates' perfidiousness, his treachery, his criminality, his... "Why," she thought, "he assaulted me. He hit me." And then she thought, "The police. I should call the police." She reached down for the phone on the table and picked it up, or tried to, but the phone seemed very heavy, or slippery, or both, and she was unable to grasp it properly. It felt wrong for her fingers. "I must be weaker than I thought," Maeve decided. "I'd better ask them to send a doctor as well." In the pocket of her jacket was a small silver phone which played Greensleeves when it rang. She was relieved to find the phone still here and that she had no problems at all in holding it. She dialed the emergency services. As she waited for someone to answer, she wondered why they still called it dialing when there weren't dials on telephones, not since she was much younger, and then after the phones with dials came the trim phones with buttons on them and a particularly annoying ring. She had, as a teenager, had a boyfriend who could and continually did imitate the breep of a trim phone, an ability that was, Maeve decided, looking back, his only real achievement. She wondered what had happened to him. She wondered how a man who could imitate a trim phone coped in a world in which telephones could and did sound like anything.
"We apologize for the delay in placing your call," said a mechanical voice. "Please hold the line."
May felt oddly calm, as if nothing bad could ever happen to her again. A man's voice came on the line.
"Hello,"
it said. It sounded extremely efficient.
"I need the police," said Maeve.
"You do not need the police," said the voice. "All crimes will be dealt with by the appropriate and inevitable authorities."
"You know," said Maeve, "I think I may have dialed the wrong number."
"Likewise," said the voice. "All numbers are ultimately correct. They are simply numbers, and cannot thus be right or wrong." "That's all very well for you to say," said Maeve, "but I do need to speak to the police. I may also need an ambulance, and I've obviously called a wrong number." She ended the call. Perhaps, she thought, 999 didn't work from a cell phone.
She pulled up her on-screen address book and called her sister's number. The phone rang once, and a familiar voice said, "Let me clarify. I am not saying that you dialed a wrong number on purpose. What I trust that I'm saying is that all numbers are by their nature correct. Well, except for pi."